The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Chha. On the show this week...
The question is really, why do we have consciousness, not why do we have this unconscious thought that we're not aware of?
The author and physicist, Leonard Mlodinow, joins me to discuss how the unconscious mind shapes our experience of the world. And...
We stopped at number 94 as the sort of upper limit of the naturally occurring elements.
What is that? Plutonium?
Plutonium, yeah. Exactly.
Filmmaker Mike Patterson is here to discuss his cinematic take on the periodic table. He wants to create a film for each of the 94 naturally occurring elements by connecting them with our everyday experiences. In the news, we'll take a look at how the protests around the genetically modified crops at Rothamsted have flared up again. And we celebrate the work of Elon Musk's SpaceX mission to the International Space Station. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Leonard Mlodinow has many hats. He's a physicist who's made important contributions to quantum mechanics. He's written for TV shows Star Trek and, crucially, MacGyver. More recently, he wrote the bestseller The Grand Design with his colleague and friend Stephen Hawking. His latest endeavour is to switch tack again and tackle the unconscious. His new book is called Subliminal, The Revolution of the New Unconscious and What It Teaches Us About Ourselves. It tries to sum up what scientists know about this strange and complex aspect of our brains. He came into The Guardian to tell me more, and when I met him, my first question was to ask him straight out, how much of our brain is dedicated to the unconscious?
Well, that's an interesting question. How much of our brain is unconscious? It depends how you measure it, but one measure is the amount of energy your brain uses in its metabolism. And imagine yourself laying on a couch, staring up at the ceiling, and your mind is completely blank, your conscious mind, that is, you're not really thinking about anything. And then let's compare that to where you're concentrating very deeply in a chess game. Suppose you're an expert. Well, the amount of energy consumption in your brain in that case will only go up about 5%. So in this measure, we would say that the brain is 95% unconscious and only about 5% conscious. So the consciousness is, in a way, the tip of the iceberg. And really the point of the book is to talk about all that's beneath the surface that you're not aware of that has a great influence on your behavior.
So the unconscious is everything from, you know, reflexes to how your brain is controlling all your bodily functions, but also, as you say, it's to do with behavior, which is probably a little bit more surprising. So what, just before we go on, just define to me what the difference between the words subliminal and unconscious are. Is there a difference?
Well, subliminal is an adjective, and it really means unconscious, yeah. And subconscious is...
Subliminal has this
today people use them pretty much interchangeably.
Yeah, but there is that connotation of being controlled in some way. Subliminal.
Right, because subliminal means below the threshold, but in this case, below the threshold of consciousness. Yeah. So I chose that word because in the 1950s, there was a famous hoax where someone said he could flash words very briefly to you while you're watching a movie, and you wouldn't perceive the words consciously, but you would do what the word said. And actually, it turns out there is a weak effect where you could actually do that, but it's probably not very useful in actual mind control. But what I found was that so there are subliminal influences that go on all the time in our environment and in the world around us that do affect us in a way that we're not aware of. And so it is a subliminal persuasion. It's just not quite of the classic type.
The one you're talking about, it's famous in films, isn't it? There's flash frames of random things happening during a scene.
That's
to
right.
Make you feel upset for some reason or something else. You're saying they don't work?
there have been laboratory experiments where people can be persuaded, let's say, to choose a certain soft drink, but not if they don't like that soft drink anyway, but perhaps they would have chosen a different one.
Yeah.
They're very fragile effects, nothing really useful, but it's still interesting.
Okay, so let's talk about some of these examples of subliminal effects on behavior. I read a piece you wrote for Scientific American recently about how it's important if you want to date someone to touch them on the arm. Now, take us through the example.
Right, that's kind of that is the way they presented it with their headline. But what I really wrote about was the effect of touch on human behavior, because the human species is really at its basis a very social species, and we wouldn't have survived in the wild and become the humans that we are today if we didn't cooperate. When, you know, in pre-civilized times, there were still human tribes, and humans had to cooperate to get prey, to avoid predators, to get food and shelter. And so we've evolved just like other primates, with social connections being very important to us. And one of the ways that all primates connect is through touch. Touch increases bonding between people and trust. And we even have specialized nerves in our arms and our face that are there specifically to transmit the social pleasure of touch. And one of the interesting studies on touch was done in France, where researchers hired several handsome Frenchmen to stand on the street corner and proposition single young women who walked by over a long weekend. And they all said the same script to the women as they walked by, said their name and asked for the woman's phone number and said they'd like to call them later. But to half of the women, they gave them a light quarter or half second touch on either the shoulder or the forearm. And to the other half, they didn't. And the question was, did this very subtle gesture increase their success rate? And actually, it doubled it from 10% to 20%. So what this, and the women in exit interviews, by the way, rarely remembered even having been touched. So they didn't even register the touch. It was very subtle. But it did affect their thinking, because what our unconscious mind does for us is it creates a picture of reality. The picture of reality is based on the real data that's out there, but also on many other things that it fills in based on our prior beliefs, our expectations, our emotions. And so when it fills in, for instance, the picture of somebody, if someone is approaching you to talk to you, there's not much data on the actual data on that person other than the few words that they say. But you're at the same time, you might be consciously assessing your face, that person's face, but on an unconscious level, you're also assessing that person's face, that person's posture, the tone of voice, whether you're touched, and all this feeds into your conscious decisions without you realizing it.
And all of this can obviously be used in many different examples. I mean, you talk about preferences of politicians and how much you give to waiters. I mean, how does it all, what other sort of a situation does it arise?
Well, with the politicians, that illustrates another factor that your unconscious uses when it builds a picture for you, and that's the person's facial appearance. A researcher in Princeton gathered pairs of photos of the candidates for several dozen races, elections for governorships and the Senate before the elections occurred, and he brought hundreds of subjects into his laboratory and showed them these pairs of faces and asked them simply, tell me which one looks more competent. And they flashed them on the screen very briefly. And the subjects were told if they recognized any of these candidates not to vote. So they're really just picking which candidate looks more competent. And then the researcher did something very bold. He predicted, based purely on the look of competence, who would win every election. And guess
these
how?
These are real elections.
Yeah. Real elections for the Senate and for the governorships all around the country in the U.S. And he was 70% accurate by just ignoring all poll data, party membership, et cetera, and basing it just on looks.
So are politicians aware of this?
Well,
political parties, do they use this information?
People are starting to use this information. Now, there's a whole field that's arisen called neuromarketing that's based just on studies like this to teach politicians and corporations and advertisers how to use this. Not necessarily a field we'd really want to develop very much, but of course the marketers have gotten into it.
Well, we'll come on to the uses of this a bit later perhaps, but it might be expected that subliminal and unconscious thoughts are present when you're picking who you trust or who you might date and all of that. But it also turns up, or the ideas in your book turn up in some unexpected places. Is it truly true that people tend to marry people of the same surname? I mean, I've heard this before, but what's that got to do with your unconscious?
Well, okay, so let's start with what your unconscious does for you in a very basic way. It builds pictures of the world, whether they're social world or the physical world. So think about you looking at me. When you look at me, you see a very sharp and clear picture of me, and you see it in 3D. But on your retina, the picture that you see of me is in 2D, obviously. And it's also not sharp at all. If you were to see an actual picture of me based solely on the data that hit your retina, it would be extremely fuzzy, and you would reject it if it was on your TV set, or you wouldn't publish it in The Guardian, that's for sure. But what your unconscious mind does is it processes that data, and it forms a clear picture. And it does it with the typical hallmark of the unconscious, which is you're not aware of it. It happens automatically. You have little or no control over it. And it's without any effort on your part. So you see a picture, don't realize your unconscious has created it from data that was really much sparser than it seems, and you think it's real. Your brain does that also in social perception. And the perception of yourself is, of course, the most important social perception. And human beings have been built to have good feelings about themselves. The people with the most realistic pictures of themselves are actually depressed people. And the rest of us have inflated views of ourselves. And there's a good reason for that. And that's because we come across many barriers in life. And in order to not become daunted and to be able to overcome those barriers, it's good to have an overly optimistic outlook.
A slightly irrational view of yourself, you mean.
Right, a slightly irrational view of yourself. And one of the aspects of that is that we tend to gravitate toward things that remind us of us. So things that are familiar and are familiar aspects of ourselves, including our names. So this is a statistical effect. It's not that if you meet someone with your last name, you're going to immediately fall in love. But if you look at hundreds and hundreds of people who have married and you filter out those the different names of people that they've married, Jones, Smith, Johnson, etc. And you, in this case, they picked about 10 names or six to 10 names. And then you look at how many of them married other names versus the same name, you'll find in every case they married more the same name than the other name. So it had enough of effect to be statistically visible. That doesn't mean you're going to just be drawn to someone with your same name.
Well, it seems evolutionarily a bit strange, doesn't it? Because the idea there surely is to marry or reproduce as someone who is as different from you as possible.
Well, evolutionarily, the names were irrelevant because there weren't, as we, our brains have not evolved much in the last 10, 20, 30,000 years. So really, that's one of the points of subliminal, is that we have a brain that we use today in our civilized society, which is advancing and changing very quickly, but it evolved when we were still living in the savannah and out in fields and in the wild. And so it's really, I don't want to quite say optimized, because in evolution you don't really say optimized, but it's evolved in a way that it's good enough for our survival out there. And that, of course, doesn't necessarily mean that it's optimal for our survival today in our civilized society, or for our stock choices or our choices of spouse. But the thing is that I do want to emphasize that the unconscious is a gift to us. So in the book, I talk a lot about illusions and strange effects like you just mentioned, and other and choosing politicians based on looks, etc. But really, overall, the unconscious mind is a great service to us, and it's what allows us to engage with each other socially, not pause every 5 seconds to try and consciously figure out what's going on, etc. We just have a feeling that we know what's going on, and it's based, again, on the real data that we're getting, plus unconscious constructions of our mind.
Now, this obviously is the seat of emotions, of course, as well, which many neuroscientists say is essentially your stock of experiences that sort of guide you from one place to another. So, in a sense, they can be described like that. But why is it that the conscious part of our minds, the bits that do the thinking and the chess playing and all of that, are so unaware of the intents and actions of the unconscious? I mean, people who read your book might be quite surprised by the number of things that we are not conscious of. But and so why would it not be better if we were conscious of all these things?
Well, we share an unconscious mind, our brain structure and chemistry, with most higher mammals. And it seems that the basis, the most basic thing that we need to survive is this unconscious, the sea of unconscious thought. The real question is, why do we have any consciousness peeking up above that? So we need to be able to operate in a smooth and efficient and quick manner and react to our environment.
The wrong way around, really.
Yeah, really. And so the question is really, why do we have consciousness, not why do we have this unconscious thought that we're not aware of? And the reason you asked why are we not conscious of it, and the social neuroscientists have just realized in the last 10, 20 years a lot about how the unconscious part of your brain arises. And this is because there's a new technology called fMRI, or functional magnetic resonance imaging, that just arose or became available in the mid-90s. And what they've discovered that's really new and revolutionary is that there are certain modules in your brain that are where the unconscious processes take place that are inherently inaccessible to your conscious mind. So this is a totally new picture of the unconscious. It's not a Freudian unconscious that's hidden from you for motivational or emotional reasons, and that you can bring into your consciousness through introspection and therapy. It's not that at all. These are unconscious processes, just like the one I described in vision, where it's happening automatically. You have no control and you have no way to access it. but we can study it with the fMRI, and we can watch what parts of your brain at any given time are doing what while you're experiencing things, while you're having thoughts, and we can see that these processes are happening, but you just can't consciously experience them.
So consciousness itself, the experience that we have of being us and interacting with people, if that is the sort of nice bit of ice cream on top of the bigger pie, we don't need the ice cream there. So why do we even have that then?
Well, that's a good question, and neuroscientists don't really understand that, and evolutionary psychologists. In today's world, of course, our consciousness allows us to create physics, to create newspapers, to have the society that we have today, but that certainly isn't necessary for our survival. And the question is, what role did it play when we lived out in the wild? And there are various theories, but nobody really understands that.
Subliminal, The Revolution of the New Unconscious and What It Teaches Us About Ourselves, is published by Alan Lane, and it's available in all good bookshops. So here to discuss this week's news stories are Martin Robbins, The Guardian's lay scientist blogger, and Observer Science and Tech editor Robin McKee. Welcome to you both, chaps. Martin, let's start with you. You were at the Rothamsted Research Station, or nearby, last weekend, defending GM crops against some hippies, as you called them in your blog. Tell us what happened.
Well, I wasn't defending them single-handedly. There were a few police as well who helped me. It was, I don't know, I guess it was kind of Python-esque, really. There was a small gang of geeks under a tree in one half of the field, and somewhere over in the distance, a few dozen, I call them hippies. People keep criticizing me for calling them hippies, but the fact is they were very hippie-ish in nature, and all playing guitars and things and baking bread and doing all those sorts of things. And to be honest, it looked like they were having quite a good time. We did wander over and steal some of the bread after a while. But it was all a little bit low-key, to be honest. I don't think they had the turnout that they were hoping for.
Take us back a couple of steps. This was a protest that was being organised by a group called Take the Flower Back to trash some crops in Rothamsted. And you guys were on the geek side to sort of front up to them a little bit. But what are the issues that were being discussed on the day?
Well, they were there to protest against a trial of aphid-resistant GM wheat that was taking place in a field nearby. The issues, to be honest, we went over and listened to them for a while, but they seemed to be quite a wide range of stuff that was often quite confused. So wandering over, we saw signs up there saying, "But what will the aphids eat?" And people were sort of talking about corporate control of the food chain, which is something that I think quite a few people are sympathetic to. But then at the same time, there were these speakers sort of setting up vast, elaborate conspiracy theories about how, you know, the fact that so many scientists support GM research must mean that there's some kind of conspiracy that organizations are all in cahoots together to try and push this sort of thing on the public. And they also had some rather odd bedfellows there. So there was a farmer up speaking as we came over who was saying that he didn't really have any need for GM crops because there was a wide range of pesticides available for him to use, which was quite an odd thing to say to get support at an anti-GM protest. But they just, I don't know, there seemed to be a sort of lack of consistency, really. And some of the people there seemed to equate the Rothamsted Research Institute with companies like Monsanto, and to not really have a very clear idea of what it was exactly that they were protesting against, other than generally, you know, the idea of tampering with nature, I suppose.
There's two issues, isn't there? One is the fact that some of these people are environmentalists who think that we're, as you say, tampering with nature, but they don't see the whole environmental picture. Your farmer there using pesticides seems to sort of miss the point with the GM crops. It's quite spectacularly. And the other is a more political one. The Green Party seemed to support this sort of trashing of the crops, which in the end didn't happen. Tell us a bit about that. You've had some interactions with other bloggers and things about this issue.
Well, Jenny Jones, a London Assembly member and London mayoral candidate for the Green Party, turned up to the protest. And now she said that she didn't support the violent aspects of it, the attempts to trash the fields. But, of course, the problem with that as a politician is you can't really associate yourself with a mob of people and then kind of wash your hands of anything that might happen later on. And so, to be honest, I found her reassurances quite weasel-worded, for want of a better term. And I think this is the problem, really. I mean, the Green Party wants to try and distance themselves from this kind of stuff, but they don't seem to be able to help themselves. And there were signs over the last couple of years that they were addressing that a bit, that they were engaging with scientists more and taking up some more pragmatic and research-based policies. But this seems to be a really, really big step backwards for them. And in a way, for the wider environmental movement as well, because I think they've succeeded in scoring a lot of own goals here. First of all, they've lost a lot of sympathy because they've come across as a lot less reasonable than the scientists that have been involved. But also there's this kind of counterproductiveness in the things that they're campaigning against. So they're campaigning against corporate control of agriculture, but the Rothamsted trials are public trials. They're aimed at being able to hold private research to account. And so I think a lot of people, I would consider myself an environmentalist as much as the next person, but I think a lot of us are just getting really fed up that this kind of noisy group of people have hijacked these debates and often ended up doing things that have damaged wider environmental causes.
One of the issues, I suppose, is that the environmental groups do say, well, we don't know what these crops are going to do in the environment. We don't know what the effects will be, so we shouldn't grow them. Well, I suppose the Rothamsted trial was specifically meant to be doing that, to work out what happens if you grow these things and look at all the issues around them. Robin, you know, this is the latest in the UK sort of history of trying to grow GM crops for whatever reason, for research or beyond. How is the debate different this time?
Well, first of all, we're not dealing with the Monsantos and the other big companies that were making these chemicals that produce their own pesticides, etc. We're dealing with something that is put forward by the scientists themselves and made publicly available and are not under patent. And the second thing is that the actual technology of the wheat is very different. It emits this chemical that basically doesn't kill aphids. People keep saying it's got pesticides in it. All it is a chemical that aphids think, oh, this is horrible. Whenever they smell it, they emit it, they smell it. And that means that there's a predator there or some reason not to be there. And so they go away. It also attracts aphid predators like ladybirds. So there's no actual pesticide being used. So it's a very different trial and a very different set of circumstances under which it's gone. And also, of course, the protesters have been caught out completely blindsided by the scientists who offered this public debate with them, which the protesters chickened out of. And I think they needed about 2,000 people turning up. They got less than 200 because the British public could see, you know, what these people were worth, which was not very much.
Martin, the scientists did, as Robin says, a few weeks ago, offer to publicly debate the protesters rather than you know, saying to them, you know, you should. They were saying to them, stop, don't damage our crops, and we'll publicly debate with you, which the protesters haven't taken up as an offer. I mean, it looked like they were going to. Is that the best way to deal with this?
Well, I mean, I must admit, I was initially a bit sceptical about the response of the scientists, purely because I was concerned that if scientists started talking to groups who threatened violence, it might sort of encourage other groups to threaten violence in order to enter public debate as well. And it's worth pointing out, actually, that another thing about this trial, you know, to add to Robin's list, is that it's actually a lot of the guidelines for this trial are based on public consultation exercises that have been done over the last 10 or 15 years. And so, you know, the public have been consulted, their input has been taken and on board in the design of the trial. But they've been incredibly unwilling to engage in that process, these groups, and incredibly unwilling to debate generally. And, you know, on the day we went over and one of the scientists with us offered to speak at their kind of rotating set of speakers that they'd set up, but we were basically told to go away. But having said all that, I think it has actually been quite good in terms of the wider public debate. I think the scientists there have come across very well. I think the fact that they've been under threat has really made them look like victims in this and has made the anti-GM protesters look like quite nasty bullies in a way. And of course, we've had an opportunity to air some of the myths about GM and clear up some of the falsehoods. And that's been very good for the public debate. And in the end, I think pretty much everyone would agree that it's been a resounding victory for the science side. And in fact, at the protest, you could tell how irked the protesters were about this, because there were a barrage of complaints about the media coverage that they'd received. And today, after my piece and James Randerson's piece, You know, groups like Take the Flower Back have been on Twitter complaining about The Guardian and our pro-GM agenda and how we must be linked to Monsanto and all this kind of stuff. So clearly they're quite aware that they've lost this debate, or at least this battle.
All right, well, fingers crossed it remains a fair victory for now. Thanks very much, Martin.
Thank you.
Robin, let's move on to space now. Last week, the SpaceX mission completed its trip to the International Space Station. Tell us what's significant about this whole exercise.
Well, it's the first time a private company has delivered the milk to the space station and got its empty bottles back as well at the end of it. The spacecraft it used is a thumping big spaceship. It's got a contract to do a lot more, but that actual spaceship that it's using could be fitted out to be filled with humans, up to 7 astronauts. Seeing the time when it used to take a government to get people into space is a big step towards private companies doing it instead.
The rocket's called Falcon, the capsule Dragon, docked with the space station. Everyone was really excited, tweeting about it. It came back. Is this the end for NASA's launch capability? And because it's commercial space is firmly on the scene now. This is it.
Yes, I mean, this is the biggest step. And then next year, I'll be at the Space Tourism of Virgin Galactic. We've got XCOR. We've got all these companies lining up. Are we seeing a shift going? Without a doubt. And what NASA is going to do about its own capability to put human beings in space is the other issue. It's just not been resolved. It's been ducked by Obama and NASA. So that's a major kind of thing to look for on the horizon. Exactly what is NASA shaping up? What will be the function of NASA that's left once this kind of rump of its activities are taken away?
It sounds like it'll be a sort of research council where it has the money, doles it out to whoever needs it and says, right, you guys take the risks, you guys build all the technology, we'll just buy something from you when we need something to get into space, we'll just buy a rocket off the shelf off you.
Yes, and we'll build this huge $5 billion probe that will go to the icy moons of Jupiter or whatever mission it is.
We need something to get it up there, yeah.
And you give us the means to get there, and that's not a bad way to do it.
You mentioned Virgin Galactic, actually. Have you been tapping up your mate Richard Branson to get onto one of those flights?
Sadly, the first one's booked up, I'm afraid.
Not the first one, maybe.
He's going with Angelina Jolie in the first one.
Of course he is.
Yeah. and Brad Pitt's going in the second one. So I'm asking, what's going on in the first one?
Why can't they both go? You mean?
Exactly. I think it's a sinister.
Well, you should get up there. And if you get the flight, then you need someone else to go on the next one.
Can I have a return ticket, though, this time?
I think they're all return tickets. Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much to Robin McKee and to Martin Robbins. For more information on all of those stories, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science. The periodic table is a brilliant way to systematically list and classify all the known elements. It's also a work of some cultural significance. The great chemist and writer Primo Levi, in his 1977 work called The Periodic Table, used the list of elements as a series of humanitarian metaphors for stories from his life. In that spirit, filmmaker Mike Patterson has created a project called 94 Elements. The idea is to create a series of short films that are each connected to an individual element. Each film will also explore a human side to our dependence on these materials. We began our conversation with a clip from one of his films, Copper.
जब एंड हो जाएंगे पानी बिल्कुल काला, इसके बाद में उसमें तार लगाकर वही पाउडर बनते हैं, इसके बाद वही भट्टी में हम लोग.
Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
What were we just hearing there? That was a film about copper. Tell us what we heard.
Yes, so that part of the film about copper, which was shot in northern India. These guys have these big vats of homemade vats of acid, which they dissolve circuit boards in to extract the copper from, and that's a sizzling sound you could hear there was the copper dissolving in these giant vats, and the whole area was filled with this kind of acrid smell of nitric acid reacting with the copper in the circuit boards.
And that's extracted and then sold on for whatever money they can make from it.
Yes, they actually make comparatively good money compared to their usual work, which is agricultural. And they gather up the copper and just sell it on to factories where it's recycled and used in kind of wiring and stuff like that.
So why 94 Elements? The name of the project is that. And so why did you choose that number?
Yes, 94 elements. Well, there's it depends on who you talk to, but there are between 90 and 94 naturally occurring elements. The idea behind the project is to explore our relationships with our natural resources. So we stopped at number 94 as the sort of upper limit of the naturally occurring elements.
What is that? Plutonium?
Plutonium, yeah. Exactly.
So that's one of the naturally occurring ones. And so you want to explore each one in some context with people.
Exactly. The idea is it's about the human stories and our human relationships and how these elements impact on our lives by telling human stories by sort of well-known filmmakers who have these great narrative abilities.
So you're building a periodic table of films, in a sense. And what's the project plan? You've made 4 films so far. We'll hear some more clips in a second, but how do you intend to make the other 90?
Yes, it's a challenge, and we're going to be making the films for the next few years at least, we imagine. We'd like to try and fund as many as possible, and that's certainly what we're setting out to do at the moment. So we're raising funding from a variety of sources. We've got a crowdfunding campaign live at the moment, and I suspect that we'll get to a certain point where we'll run out of both sort of energy and money to carry on fundraising, at which point I think it'd be quite nice to hand over any elements films haven't been made for to the internet in general and see what emerges out of that.
Now let's hear from another film. This is by the BAFTA winner Mark Isaacs. It's a film about oxygen. Do you want to just introduce it for us?
Yes, this is it's a very powerful film Mark made about a guy who's got severe respiratory difficulties, so he has a lot of trouble breathing. And he's bedbound and hasn't actually been outside his flat since, I think it was 1982. And Mark just spent a single night with him. And the kind of finished film is a very powerful piece of work, I think.
God, am I feeling safe when I get back to bed. Wonderful.
Bob, when was the last time you were able to walk properly?
Oh, a long time ago. Let me see. 4 years ago.
So that was an excerpt of the film Oxygen by Mark Isaacs. That one, Mike, was all about all of our dependence on oxygen. If we don't have this stuff, then you die. Is there an overall theme to the films you want to make? We mentioned earlier it's about the relationship of these 94 elements to people. But what is the theme? Is it one of positive and optimism? That we're running out? Is it that we don't realise that we're dependent on these things? What's your sort of thinking?
It's about awareness of the role that these elements play in our lives. My original idea for the project came from reading an article about the sort of consumption rates of which we're using up some of the elements. Indium, for example, which is used in flat-screen TVs, mobile phones, at current consumption rates, we could run out within 10 years. I was very interested in doing a project around the processes of production for each of these elements, so either the mining activities or the sort of extraction facilities. But then I very quickly sort of added up 94 films. How long is that going to take? How am I going to raise the money? And it quickly became a sort of crowdsourced project, which is the kind of logical path for it to go. It's fairly obvious to me that the way we currently manage our resources and the production cycles for our resources are not really sustainable sort of moving forwards. So it's a kind of playful and creative way of approaching that subject, but without being too preachy.
I know that some Japanese researchers have been looking at ways of what they call urban mining, which is these landfills, which are full of rich materials, all our phones, all our various electronic gadgets that we throw away into landfill, but essentially are a kind of useful resource of all this stuff, right? We used to get them from ore, now we just get them from landfills. We could do, potentially. Let's listen to another clip. This one is a less familiar element, I would say, gadolinium. Can you tell us a bit about this one?
Yes, gadolinium. So gadolinium is used when you have an MRI scan. You normally have an injection of gadolinium, and what it does is it helps to improve the contrast ratio in the image, so it helps to show contrast between damaged and healthy tissue. And this film was made by Nino Katadze, who won at Sundance 3 years ago, and she tells this lovely sort of human story about a guy going for an MRI scan and the sort of confusion that ensues from looking at the results. It was shot in Tbilisi in Georgia.
Ok, Okay, that was a film about gadolinium by Nuno Catarse. Now, one thing, Mike, is that you're obviously someone who's made a lot of science films. Colliding Particles was your last major project, which we've featured, and we're big fans of John Butterworth, as you know, as are you, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
What's can you even think beyond 94 Elements? Well, what's next?
At the moment, it's very hard.
95th Element.
Well, there are, you know, there are 117, so we could go into the artificial ones,
right?
Couldn't we? It's very hard to think beyond the 94 right now.
What about the people you want to bring together to make these 94 films, though? You've got some high-profile names already, and you want independent filmmakers to come and do them. Do you want people who've never made science films before, or would you prefer people who understand the chemistry of all these things? What's your sort of preference?
No, we want everyone. It's possibly an advantage if you haven't made science films before, because we're not positioning this project as a science project. It's much, much broader, we hope. I'd love some animators to make some films. I'd love some animated documentaries. And one of the other, so there's the kind of serious side of the project, which is about our resources, but then there's the playful and creative side, and it's really a celebration of the diversity of the documentary form is what we want to see. So we want to see sort of political films and personal films, animated, and so the whole range of documentary forms you want to see sort of contained within the project.
Now, people who are interested in pitching something might be slightly too late for this current round, but when will you next open this up, and where can they find out more information?
Well, we have our crowdfunding campaign, which is live at the moment, which is on Indiegogo. So that's indiegogo.com/94elements. And you can watch the first films on 94elements.com right now. And if you sign up to the mailing lists or follow us on Twitter there, you'll be the first to hear about the next round of pitching opportunities that we're going to be running.
Fantastic. Mike, thank you very much. And when you've made your next five, please come back on and let's have some more clips.
I'd love to.
To find out more about Mike Patterson's project, go to 94elements.com. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. The programme was made this week with thanks to radio producer Claire Freeman. Until next time, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.